Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 414 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 25th of January, 2019, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Tammy Labreck about email lists for authors. And this is really a packed interview full of tips, and it will help you with changing your attitude to email, which is often something I need. reader magnets, onboarding, what to do if you're just starting out, frequency and content of emails, list cleaning, which is something we all need to do, and even how to make email more fun. Yes, Tammy is a fantastic guest. She's very lively, and I know you will get something useful from this interview, whatever stage you're at. It's good if you're just starting out or if you're at a more developed stage. I certainly got some things for my to-do list. listen in for that. In publishing news, probably the most exciting story, I think, this week, and one that I think has been coming for years, let's face it. Wattpad has launched Wattpad Books, a new publishing division headed by Ashley Gardner, who's been on this show several times talking about Wattpad over the years. And I've hung out with Ashley in lots of different places around the world, actually. We had a wonderful time in Berlin one year, she's been with Wattpad a long time. And we've seen movie deals come out of Wattpad, we've seen TV shows, we've seen book deals, and it's just a fascinating platform. And if you're a regular user of Wattpad and you publish on Wattpad, you'll know what I mean. I, back in the day, years ago, did try it, but it is definitely one of those platforms where you need to be engaged. But basically, some of the information from the Publishing Perspectives article, which I'll link to, they have six titles coming out this fall and will be using their algorithmic search capability to find other books to publish, known in their business as the Story DNA Machine Learning system. So this is publishing helped by AI, and they need help because there are 565 million uploads of content on Wattpad, known as stories. But of course, the quality will vary and the engagement will vary. And the word quality, they're used in a deliberately kind of open term, because what's so awesome about this kind of new world of data analysis of story and engagement is the things that some people might consider not popular are actually turning out to be really popular. So they're going to use this to track the reader response, to look at the international trends as they support more than 50 languages. They have 70 million active monthly users, spending an average of 37 minutes per session. So these are readers or writers. That's amazing. 37 minutes. 90% of the users are Gen Z or millennials and access on mobile devices. And young women are about 70% of the readership and the writers. There are strong, loyal communities around inclusivity and diversity issues. And to date, nearly 1,000 Wattpad stories have been turned into books and or adapted for television, film and digital project in the last 12 years. So this, I think, is an not surprising to me. I think this has been coming a long time, but really awesome to see the Wattpad community turning into different ways of benefiting the authors on the platform for ways of monetizing their content, because Wattpad hasn't up to this point been a publisher, and the actual system still won't be a publisher as such. It's more like a social network for sharing your writing. But the writing that is on there, you know, some of which has gone on to be super popular. So that is really interesting. Congratulations to Wattpad, and congratulations also to Ashley Gardner. My personal update this week. Well, I have been recording the Productivity for Authors lecture or mini course, which I will have finished next week. And it's always really good to teach something because it helps you organize your own thoughts. And I have definitely had some breakthroughs in what I would call productivity in the last year around culling things, which I think is really important, elimination. And I have a whole thing on that. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you soon. I've also been listening to a fantastic audiobook. And if you're interested in audiobook narration, definitely get Storyteller, How to Be an Audiobook Narrator by Lorelei King. And it's absolutely brilliant. I'm going to listen to it several times. It's only a couple of hours long, but it is absolutely packed with tips for how to be an audiobook narrator. And it's only available as an audiobook. And there's also a producer on there who talks about different things too. So really good. And thanks to Jeff Adams, co-host of the Big Gay Fiction podcast, for letting me know about that. And of course, Jeff and co-host Will have the best name in the podcast industry. I just love it. I'm also still progressing with my project. This year, one of my goals is be a better publisher. And I am getting all my books in hardback, large print, as well, obviously, as ebook, audiobook, and normal paperback. And The Healthy Writer and Stone of Fire arrived yesterday in hardback. I'm not ordering all the copies of all of them, because I'll just end up spending loads of money on my books. But I am filling my shelves with my hardbacks, and I'm sorry, like, they are gorgeous. I really like them. I mean, I'm happy with my print-on-demand paperbacks all the way, but the hardbacks, they're just good. So I'm very happy with that. I'm even doing a hardback with my I've just redone 1,000 Fiendish Angels, which I've talked about. I've recorded that. We're still doing retakes, because obviously I'm not an expert narrator yet, so we're still doing retakes on my stories. But yeah, I'm even doing a hardback for the short story, so really cool fun. You can produce hardbacks with print on demand through Ingram Spark. And what's interesting also is on the Amazon Author Central page. So if you go to amazon.com or .co.uk, I think they're the main stores that have it, and look at my page, obviously, Joanna Penn or JF Penn, they now separate that page into formats. So you can see Kindle, audiobook, paperback, hardcover, and large print, all as separated on that page. So clearly that's all in the metadata. It's all in the search stuff. So yeah, I just think it's going to be so interesting. I mean, I only do, you guys are going to laugh. Those of you who are into data, you'll laugh. I really only do my stats once a year when I do my taxes. Obviously, I track my money every day, but I do not track my book sales. So I don't know at the moment how many books in different formats are selling. So at the end of the year, obviously last year when I reported on my breakdown, print had gone from 10% of my book sales income to 21% of my book sales income. And this year, it will be interesting to see if that's expanded even more. And in fact, it's not really fair to compare it, because I haven't had everything in place. But the more interesting year will be 2020, when I'll have basically everything and I can compare things for a whole year. So very fascinating. And also, I hope that some of my income from print and also ebook and audio is going to be library purchases and borrows. I'm getting really interested in this, especially around audiobooks, because you should be able to get my ebooks, audiobooks, and also print books. You can, if you request the librarian to order them, in your local library. And this is a really interesting thing. And I'll be talking to more about this with Will from Find A Way Voices in an upcoming interview. We've already recorded the interview, it's coming up. But this is just fascinating. So yeah, I did want to ask if you do use your library systems to see, I mean, obviously you don't need to use one of your boroughs, but if you can see whether any of my books are there, Joanna Penn or JF Penn. And I'm just really interested to see if, I haven't gone into this before. So, and this would be like a win-win for people, and obviously a tip for everyone else as well. It's a win-win to say, hey, you can get my books for free at the library. And especially if it's an audiobook, because ebooks and print books, we get paid for once. But with Find A Way, which we'll talk about, as I said, coming up, you can potentially get a money per checkout. So that is a really interesting revenue stream that I hadn't really been aware of before. I thought it was a one-off payment, but the per checkout model, which Drafter Digital have also been talking about. I do think that libraries are another sort of frontier for indies. Yeah, so interesting. I am going to hopefully talk to someone about this in more detail. So if you are someone who has done really well with library outreach and income from libraries in the last couple of years, so really realistically with audiobooks, ebooks, not just print books in the old model, I'd be really interested in hearing from you how you're doing library outreach and marketing. So please, yeah, email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. Megan Fuentes says, listening to the podcast with cold legs because Rochelle won't relinquish the blanket. And a picture of Rochelle, who's a very cute black kitten. Just such a nice picture. Amy thought my sparking dark joy was hilarious from last week. good morning to Pete Bauer, who's listening on the way to work. And also to Richard, who says, I listen to you while delivering in my van and often have to pull over to scribble quick notes about something you've said. So safe driving, Pete and Richard, and everyone who's listening while they're driving. And also a shout out to Margot, who sent a lovely email. And I'm really pleased I can continue to inspire writers at all stages of the journey is really important to me. And finally, thanks to the paperboy who said, having to do a bit of traveling today and completely forgot anything other than my phone to take notes with, but at least it's a chance to catch up on the latest podcast for a motivated Monday. Fantastic. Right, so today's show is sponsored by Readzy, which is the curated marketplace for editors, cover designers, marketing professionals, which many of you ask for, design, websites, and even ghostwriting. Readzy vet all the listed freelancers, and this, I think, is why I recommend them so much. You can be sure they're delivering a quality service because they make sure that the people are great. And also they have an ability to tell them if it's not. They also have a free online book formatter, lists of book review bloggers and book promotion sites, and loads of free training with everything from writing in different genres, publishing tips on different platforms, tutorials on Facebook ads, Amazon ads, and much more. So check out Readzy at thecreativepen.com/Readzy, R-E-E-D-S-Y. So they know I sent you. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription, and editing of the show, which you can imagine is substantial. But my time in creating the show is sponsored by my wonderful patrons supporting me on Patreon. Thanks to everyone supporting the show, and thanks to new patrons, Lena Olson Lalore, Richard Davis, Tamara Nikolai, Kim Reynolds, Pete Bauer, Nicola Scott, and Lorna Duneva. Thank you so much to everyone. And I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. It reminds me that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with a couple of dollars a month, less than a coffee a month, and or a couple of coffees if you're generous. And you get the extra monthly Q&A audio plus the backlist. So if you want to learn more about self-publishing and writing and marketing, you can download all that tasty Q&A audio and you'll have a lot to listen to. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today I'm here with Tammy Labreck. Hi Tammy.
Hi Joanna.
Oh, it's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Tammy is an author, editor, and publisher. She writes fiction under a number of different pen names. And today we're talking about her brilliant and super useful book, Newsletter Ninja, How to Become an Author Mailing List Expert, which is just an amazing topic. But Tammy, before we get into that, tell us a bit more about you and how you got into writing and publishing.
Well, I've always written, you know, one of those people who have written as long as I can remember. But that was back in the olden days. I'm in my 40s. So that was, you know, the 80s and the 90s when you did the whole query letter thing and you tried to get an agent and blah, 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 blah. I was published once way back. I had a short story published by Marion Zimmer Bradley, which was a real feather in my cap at the time. I was very, very young, like 20. But I never was successful in getting like novel length things published. And then I got married and I had kids and, you know, whatever, life happens. Around about like, I don't know, 2010, 2011, I had one of the early Kindles. So around like 2010 or 2011, I started to understand what was going on with indie publishing. I started to see that people were actually really doing this. And I started following your podcast, the SPP, the various podcasts that people had. And I thought, I might like to do that. But, you know, it's hard to take the plunge. By that point, I was a single mom. I had divorced and, you know, I had a job and it had health insurance and, you know, retirement plan. So fine. But then in the fall of 2014, I lost that job. Mm. And so I kind of had a choice, right? Like, okay, I can get another crappy office job with health insurance and a retirement plan, or I can do this thing that I've kind of been thinking about doing, but hadn't made the plunge. And so I made the plunge. I put up a short story, that short story actually, that had been published way back in the black and white days of the 90s. I put that up on Amazon in November or December of 2014, published a romance novel in February, another in May. And by June, I was supporting us with my writing, which is not quite as impressive as it sounds because I live in central Maine, which is very inexpensive. But so that's what got it all started. And I picked up editing kind of as a side hustle. There was a period in 2016 where really that was kind of more of a side hustle. 2016 wasn't a great year, but in 2017, my writing income started going back up, and it's been uphill ever since then. And of course, I had a brief period where I was employed by Sterling and Stone there from late 2016 to late 2017, when I left them to have more writing time, really. And that was kind of my first exposure to a really like large scale newsletter enterprise. Because of course, when you're just one author, you just got a little thing, but they had this whole huge scalable thing. And I really learned a lot doing that.
Well, that's fantastic. And it's interesting living in Maine, because one of the things I think is a really good tip is if people's living costs are too high and they want to go full time, it's actually moving somewhere cheaper. So yeah, I think
it totally is.
It totally is. But I just tell us, so at the moment, so you're writing under different pen names, but what different genres are you writing and how many pen names do you have? You don't need to tell us what they are, but just what are the different kind of categories?
I write romance. I write lit RPG. I am working on, but not yet published, in urban fantasy. Actually, I have two romance pen names. I'm trying to think of them all. Two romance pen names, lit RPG. I did do a reverse harem for a while, but actually I'm not doing that anymore. That was fun. And I'm working on a thriller. That's my newest pen name, which is part of the reason. Well, we'll talk about the course later, but I'm winding the course down quite a bit. And that's part of why, is because I need time for that pen name. So mostly it's my romance and my lit RPG that I write the most.
Okay, fantastic. Right, so we're going to get into the book now and we're going to cycle back to the pen names in a minute. But first of all, I open your book and you're a very upbeat person, which I love, and you're very jolly and everything. And that comes across in the book, which is great, because I think under anyone else's writing, it could have been quite dry, but it's not dry. It's actually really, you know, upbeat. But I had to call you out on saying email can be fun. And I was like, What is she talking about? Email being fun? So I gotta sort of ask you, like, how can we change our mindset so email is fun? And why do authors have such an issue with email?
I think that part of the reason that authors have an issue with email is that they're not doing it right. If we work under the assumption that the stuff I talk about in Ninja is like the right way. So let's work under that assumption. I think that they don't know what to say. They're always selling. They wonder if maybe they wouldn't be better off running some advertising or writing. You know, we often are better off writing than messing around with any of the other stuff. And because they're not making it fun. They're not. For me, when I send out a newsletter, it's not a selling proposition for me. I'm not sending the newsletter wondering, like, will I sell any books? Will I make any money? Is this worth my time? Is a question that you could ask. But I don't ask that question. When I email, I'm talking to people who are like me and people who like me, which is great, about stuff that we have in common. So, like, how can that not be fun? You know, if I'm talking to my lit RPG crowd about, you know, whatever gaming it is that I'm doing right now, or if I'm like slagging off on Fallout 76 or whatever, or if I'm talking to my romance people about, you know, whatever television show I'm watching that has all the feels, because romance people love all the feels. Like, that's fun. That's super, super fun for me. And once you start to have a pretty engaged email list and you know that you're going to get a lot of replies, I think that that's really motivating as well, because you get to hear back from people. And that kind of feedback is always really invaluable.
Mm, right. So a couple of questions out of that then. So back to the pen names. What about separating lists? Because I think this is a really major question for people. I mean, I have two main names and two lists for my fiction and nonfiction. But then even within fiction, I have thrillers, I have crime, I have something that could be more supernatural. You have all these quite different things. So for people listening, you know, do you recommend separating email lists, even if people are writing under one name, for example?
I do, actually. I tend to segregate quite a bit. I segregate by genre. And even within genre, like I have more than one romance name, I will separate them out based on that. Readers are a lot more genre loyal, even down to the level of being subgenre loyal, than I thought they were before I started writing and marketing. Because as a reader, and I think most authors are like this, I have always read everything since I was a kid. I would read whatever. I would read the back of the ketchup bottle if that was the only thing on the table, right? So we tend to think like, oh, people will follow me wherever. And there are very few people that that is true about. But for the most part, I tend to separate them. There's technical reasons for it. You know, if you talk about, whether you want the wrong sorts of books getting into your also bots, how you want to feed the Amazon algorithm engine, that kind of thing. But I also find that separating them helps because I don't want to be talking to people about things that they're potentially not interested in. That I think is a really quick way to get some disengagement. If I were, for example, to send my billionaire romance people something that was paranormal, say, a lot of them are not interested. And so they may begin to open fewer of my emails or buy fewer of my books. And so I keep them pretty segregated. That's just my way of doing it. But I think that it helps. And if you have like your situation where you have fiction and nonfiction, you definitely want to separate it, because I do know that for a while, one of my romance pen names releases early last year. My class always knows I tend to talk about my pen names with my class. They're kind of, because there's just a few of them. But for whatever reason, I reached this critical mass and one of my romance pen names, first also bought on her romance, her most recent romance, was David Gogren's Strangers to Superfans. Oh. And so that was clearly a problem, right? That was clearly a problem. And that book subsequently didn't sell very well. Imagine that. So I'm big on segregating.
Yeah, I mean, I am too. I definitely agree with you on that. The other thing I think people are probably feeling already is you're emailing and you're saying, oh, these are the types of gaming things I'm doing. These are the types of TV shows. So it's this concept of sharing personal stuff that I think many people in general probably have an issue with. And maybe because we're reaching a point with social media and privacy, and I almost feel like that fear is coming back up again, this sort of how much can you share openly about your life on an email list? So can you address that fear that people have, and where's the line, I guess?
Yeah, I think that that is a very real thing. I always wind up with at least one person in every class who says, I'm not, there are people who I've taken class with that I haven't even seen because they have their cameras closed when we do our one-on-one conversations. There are people who are super private. I also have students who send baby pictures. Like, they just literally do not care. They are an open book. And the people who are more private are often very concerned about that exact thing. They're like, I don't want to tell people where I live. I don't want to tell them my real name. I don't want to tell them, you know, this, that, or the other. And for me, I think it's really important to remember that you can be authentic with people and you can even share things that are personal, if you want to call them that, without ever revealing anything that you're not comfortable with, right? So I'll call her out. Lucy Score is a former student of mine. She's a romance writer, a very successful romance writer, and super engaging, very fun, very active Facebook group, very good email list. But if you were to really drill down and say, what do I know about Lucy? What do her readers know? They don't know where she lives. She doesn't post pictures of her husband, for example. She's very private about that. what you know about Lucy is the kind of movies she likes. You know that Lucy loves tacos. She's very big on tacos. It's a whole thing in her group. So she shares these little bits about herself that enable people to identify with her without ever giving away anything that just feels like too much to her. And I think that you can definitely do that. Telling somebody that you've been to see Infinity War doesn't really tell them a lot about you because everybody saw Infinity War, right? But you can talk to your readers about that. And if you write, you know, superheroes or urban fantasy or even science fiction, you've probably got a lot of overlap there in your audience. And you guys can have a great conversation that enables you to identify with each other and you still haven't given away anything that's too much for you.
It's so funny, though, because I hear you saying that, and I know you're right, because I've been doing this a while, too. But it took me, I think, 6 years of writing before I shared openly that I like going to graveyards and cemeteries, and that they're in pretty much all my books. And, you know, I go to graveyards for fun. You know, it's like a tourist thing. I'm a taphophile. And what's so funny is now people send me photos when they travel, they go traveling and they go to graveyards. I get sent graveyard pictures. Now, some people listening are going to think that's creepy, but those people who think that's cool, they're my people. But I was afraid of sharing that. And in a way, that kind of fits into the same category as you're saying. I mean, in a way, you know, it's about judgment, isn't it? It's kind of fear of judgment that you're giving away something that you care about, even if it's not a picture of your kid. You know what I mean?
I definitely do think so. And I think that people will try kind of just instinctively to make their newsletter something that everyone will enjoy. And I would actually say that that's going to be the most boring newsletter that anybody's ever written. So make your newsletter something that your tribe is going to be nuts about. So your email list does not have to consist of every person who has ever read one of your books or who might read one of your books. It needs to consist of the people who are like, Joanna's so cool with that graveyard thing she has going on. Like, those are that's your tribe. That's your people. Mm-hmm. If somebody thinks that's too weird or you're too chatty or they don't want to hear about what movies you're seeing or whatever it is that about your newsletter that might turn them off, hey, they can follow you on BookBub or they can follow you on Amazon or whatever. But that core people, that core set of people that's on your newsletter, they'd be what, you know, Dave Goggren calls super fans. Those are the people who are going to buy every book you write on release day at full price. And they're your people. And I think you cultivate those people by being yourself and being super authentic.
Mm. Okay, so we've established some things there about, you know, what should go in the newsletter, but let's just sort of wind it back to the idea of the reader magnet, which many people have talked about for many years. And, you know, the sort of, should you have a free book that you give away? Should you give away a whole load of books? But I think people are still confused about this. So what's the best reader magnet? And what if you're just starting out and you haven't kind of got anything?
Okay, so I feel really strongly about this. Actually, I could go on at length, but I'll try to hit just the high points. I think that your reader magnet should be a piece of your writing, full stop. I really very firmly believe that. A book, a novella, a short story, I don't care. But I believe that it should be a piece of your writing and a complete piece of your writing. I'm really not a big fan of giving away, like, say, the first three chapters of your book.
Yeah.
So a complete piece of your writing, I'm a really big believer that it should be something exclusive, something that can only be gotten on your newsletter list. A lot of people like to give away something that is, say, for sale on Amazon, and they feel like people will join the list because they would rather save the money. But interestingly, that doesn't actually play out when you actually try it. Chris Fox, in particular, shared his numbers with me of how well his reader magnet got signups before and after he put it up on Amazon. And the results were not surprising. Signups went way down when someone could actually buy it instead of joining. So people having to hand over the email address to get that really makes a big difference. It's kind of cool to give away, I don't know the word I'm looking for, peripheral stuff that's not your writing. Like Mark Dawson has that like dossier on John Milton, which I think is super, super cool. But he does also give away writing as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think that is really important. If you only have one book, I think the best thing you can do for yourself is to write a story to go along with it. A prequel. If you're writing something that has villains, people love a prequel that shows how the villain became the bad guy. If you're writing paranormal romance, say, people love a prequel or a scene that's in the book told from the point of view of the hero instead of the heroine. If you write contemporary romance, people love an extended epilogue, a marriage, a honeymoon, whatever. Christmas stories. So people are nuts about holiday stories and Christmas in particular. I think I sell more Christmas stories than romance stories and than Valentine stories. And I'm a romance writer. So, okay. So if you can just write, and it doesn't have to be long, it could be 5,000 words. It does not have to be a huge thing, but something that takes place in the same world as, or about the same people as one of your books or series is kind of the perfect intersection of reader interest and time investment. So I recommend that very strongly. A quick example, my daughter has actually just released her first book. I'm super proud of her. She's just released her first book, which is an urban fantasy. And her reader magnet is actually a little story that takes place during the course of the novel, but it really didn't fit in the novel. It's hard to explain. But so the characters have to go do a thing. Something happened and they're like, oh, we forgot about the thing. And they run and they solve that problem. And that is like a side story sort of. And that's her reader magnet working like gangbusters. The book is selling very well and we're getting a really steady stream of people because at the end of the book, it says, do you want to find out what happened when they went to, it's, they're going to pick up a zombie hamster at the vet.
Cool.
Long story. Do you want to hear what happens when they went to get Hervé at the night vet? And, selling like crazy. And then lots of people are signing up because when you get to the end of that story, if you liked that story, do you want to know what happened when is a no-brainer, total no-brainer. So working out really well. And I think that the dovetailing of whatever series or book you're leading them from over to the newsletter, if those things intersect, I think that they're more likely to be a yes. However, that said, it is also good if your reader magnet can bring in what you would call cold leads. And I know people who have more than one. I know people who write a reader magnet for each series, and then maybe they have one that just kind of stands alone. Because if you can read the reader magnet without having read your series, and it will interest you to read the series, then you can do cross promotion with other people. And those are really good list builders right now. If you say, write romance, and you ask five of your romance friends, hey, do you have a book funnel link for a reader magnet? And you guys all just email about it. It's a great way to cross-pollinate your lists.
Fantastic. And you mentioned book funnel there, bookfunnel.com. We're not going to go into any technical setup, but yeah, we all use bookfunnel.com these days, don't we, for delivery. Just tell people the name of the author name your daughter's writing under in case anyone wants the zombie hamster.
She's going to kill me. Don't go mess up her also bots, guys. But if you do buy urban fantasy, her pen name is Ginevra Black. And the book is called Rune Awakening, like a pun on Rude Awakening, but it's about Norse mythology. So Rune Awakening is what it's called.
Okay, cool.
And it's amazing. And there's a zombie hamster. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. So if you like those kind of books only, then go check that out. Yeah. And we're not messing up also bots here. So the other thing there, I guess, is nonfiction. I mean, I've done nonfiction for years, just anything useful. You know, I have basically what is a book, my author blueprint, but it is, still a PDF. After 10 years, it's been updated. But so nonfiction, I think, is much easier than fiction. But you've given some great examples there, which
With nonfiction, you can do so many things. You can do material that didn't make it into the book that ended up being an outtake or that you didn't know at the time of your nonfiction writing that now you would add if you were to, say, do an update. You can do worksheets. You can do brainstorming sheets. You can do there's all kinds of adjunct material. So basically anything that's going to make your book more useful to the people who are ostensibly going to pick it up. And then, of course, again, you want to think about cold leads in case somebody says, you should check out this cool thing I got from Joanna Penn. If it stands alone and then leads into the rest of your stuff, then that's a perfect kind of two-way street.
And what about authors? So I get this email question all the time. I'm an author writing my first book. I've been told I need to build an email list. So they haven't got anything at all. And they're focusing their writing energy on writing that first book. So I generally say, hey, don't worry about it too much.
But what I do the same.
You do. Okay. So do you think people should even try or?
Well, we did build, I'll call her Ginevra. We did build Ginevra's email list up just a little bit before the book came out because the story, while I think that it reads a little bit better if you know the story, the bulk of the story actually does not contain any of the main characters from the book because it's happening at this veterinarian. that doesn't sound very exciting, but it's, I mean, zombies, they're zombies. So we did actually put that up. We ran a Facebook ad to it and got a bunch of signups that way. And I also had some urban fantasy. I have a lot of friends, obviously, that are authors. And I had a bunch of urban fantasy authors share it with their audience as well. And so she did. She was able, when she launched book one, to launch it to a list of a couple hundred people instead of just launching it to nothing, which is, you know, infinitely better than nothing. So if you can come up with something short and you have the time to write it, I think it's well worth taking a couple of days to knock out something short and just get a cover made up for it. Doesn't even have to be a particularly good cover, as I know from the hamster one, you'll see. And just get a cover made for it and throw that up on BookFunnel and start collecting people, because the sort of people who are interested in that thing are probably going to be interested in the book that goes along with it. So you will be collecting people that are kind of predisposed already to like whatever's coming after. That said, would I be better off writing is a really valid question. And if you're, say, trying to write three books so you can get them all set up for rapid release, I would say go ahead and write your three books and then maybe think about the reader magnet after, because you don't want to like mess up your forward momentum. You don't want to stop doing the thing that you're doing that is working very hard towards your success to talk about marketing. I think the writing is always the first thing that we do. It should always be the first thing we think about. And then we think about newsletters. I think about newsletters before I even open my ad dashboard. Some people have a different priority. That's fine. But at some point you do have to build it. I don't know anybody who's successful without one. That's a straight up lie. T.S. Paul is an urban fantasy writer who does not have a newsletter.
But he is he's a rapid writer.
He's a very rapid writer, and he does have a website, which apparently gets a great deal of traffic. He's just got a different way of interacting with his readers. But he's the only one I know. Everybody else I know definitely credits their newsletter with success.
Yes, me too. Absolutely. Okay, so we've got our reader magnet going, and then we're like, okay, great, I've done that. People just sign up, they get the thing. But then what do I do? So what do we put? And I have an autoresponder sequence or onboarding. Some people call it onboarding. So what goes in that automatic sequence of emails after sign up?
All right. So what do I put in my onboarding? So obviously the first thing that you're going to want is an introduction to yourself. You're going to deliver whatever it is that you promised them. If you're bribing them onto the list, you deliver that, you introduce yourself. Here's who I am. Here's what I write. Here's what sorts of things you can expect from me. I also like an email, a separate one, maybe if you have several books. But for a long time, my steamy romance pen named The Billionaire one, she had two books. So she had a single onboarding email. I mean, she didn't have much to say. So I accomplished it all kind of in one email. You do the introductions, talk to them about your catalog. Here's the stuff that I write and here's why I write it. When you're talking to them about your catalog, I think the important thing, especially in an onboarding sequence, even more than in a campaign, is that you do not want to come off like you're pushing people to buy something. This is an introduction, best foot forward. So you talk about your books with enthusiasm. And of course, if you mention the title, you make it a hot link because you are trying to sell books. But I never, ever say, you know, you should buy this book. You should do whatever. I say, this is the book I wrote. Here's something cool about it. And next week I'll tell you about this other series that I write. Right. And so you walk them through your catalog in whatever way seems to make sense to you. I'm a fan of keeping onboarding sequences somewhat short, mostly because I want to get people into the list proper, because I think I send really fun newsletters and it will be really engaging. But I do like the onboarding to kind of weed people out. So my onboarding, for example, my romance pen name, she tends to send sort of long chatty emails, you know, sassy best friend style emails. So that's what my onboarding sequence looks like. If I've got a person who's very no nonsense, I just want to know when you have a new book, I don't need any of this crap, then they will show themselves out during the course of the onboarding sequence because they'll realize they don't like the emails that they're getting. And that means the people who wind up on the list are already kind of filtered, which I think is really smart. And I think that's the most important thing, really, that your onboarding does. It lets people know what they can expect from the list so that the people who don't belong there will just, they'll unsubscribe during the automation portion. And that's fine. When people unsubscribe from my list, this is my best ninja trick, I guess. When people unsubscribe from my list, the page that they get and the follow-up email that they get has links to follow me on Amazon and on BookFunnel. So if you just want to know when there's a new book, click one of these and you can go follow me there. And I think that, I mean, I don't have any way to know because they don't tell me who's following me. But my BookBub subscribers do tend to go up pretty steadily. So I think actually that's probably helping. And that way, like I said, the people who wind up on the list, they're primed. They're like, oh, she writes these long chatty emails. They're hilarious. I love them.
I love that because that tip was great. I need to go do that. So that's that was a good one. I'm interested. So now let's, I guess, get into the actual newsletter. So there you're talking, you know, you said you love, you said again, the word fun newsletter and writing newsletters. So again, what's in those regular updates that you do? How often do you send them? So any tips for that section?
So a lot of the when, how often do you send depends on how often you release, right? So I really believe that your newsletter should probably give some kind of value. We can talk about value in a second. Should probably give some kind of value more often than it asks people to do stuff. I call it the give to ask ratio, which is a super clever thing to call it. And I think it's really important that it's always skewed in favor of the subscriber because nobody wants a friend who just keeps asking you for stuff. That's super obnoxious. So in terms of how often you should send, often enough that every email is not a sales email. So if you're releasing once a month, probably want to email twice a month, you know, so that there's at least one email that doesn't say, go buy my book, which is really important. Because my don't sell in your newsletter rule is totally broken on release day. Of course, go buy my book because I just wrote it and it's awesome. So you should definitely send often enough that you're not always asking for something. If you release infrequently, you know, some people are only writing 3 or 4 books a year. You should still probably...
Wait. Some people are only writing one book or 2 books a year, or even one every couple of years.
That's a good point. Man, I hang out with a lot of overachievers.
Yeah, you totally do.
I totally do. I personally am kind of a 4 books a year person, which is why none of those pen names are bestsellers. But I like a lot of different things and that's just how it is. If you can really focus, I know people that are releasing every couple weeks and that's crazy talk, but they're doing it. So they should probably email every week. But you should email every month, regardless of how often you're releasing, at least every month, because there's definitely an element, just a technological element, where the receiving email providers like Gmail or Hotmail or whatever will your what they call your reputation. It sort of resets or falls back. We're not sure after some period of time. Again, we're not sure, but it seems to be about the 1 month mark. And so if you send very infrequently, like every 3 months, Gmail, Hotmail, Yahoo, they don't have a chance to understand that you're a trusted sender for these people that are opening your emails. And what you want, of course, is to send frequently and have people open and click and reply to your various emails. Those are the things that signal, oh, this is a good sender, and your open rates will be better as a result. So at least once a month. As for what you say, it can vary, obviously, depending on what it is that you write and what kind of list you have, what kind of people are on your list and your comfort level, like we talked about. But you can talk about what you're reading is a huge one, which I'm pretty sure I stole straight from Nick Stevenson way back in the day. I remember him saying that you should always ask in your emails, you should ask people, what are they reading? And it will get them to reply. And I thought, yeah, we want to talk about books. People are reading books. They like books. So I always talk about what I'm reading. Twice a year, J.D. Robb has a new book. That's Nora Roberts. I always post about my new J.D. Robb that I'm reading. If Lucy has a new book, I tell people Lucy has a new book. So that's a huge one. They're readers. That's definitely going to be something that you have in common. So that's always a good go-to. But also other media. What are you watching? What are you watching for TV? What are you watching for movies? If you're the sort who talks about your family or about travel or things like that, you can talk about those things. You can share images from where you're going. Pets. People are crazy about pets. I get more people coming through my class that are like, I don't even like cats. And I'm like, it doesn't matter because you readers do, I promise. They're nuts about pets. My youngest daughter adopted a tarantula and I sent
<That's> brilliant.
I sent my romance list, not a picture of, because don't put a picture of a spider in an email. That's rude. But I sent them a link in the PS. It said, if you want to see my daughter's tarantula, you can click on this link and you will see this picture. And I could not believe the number of people who click through to look at this horrible thing that she, because they are horrible. So they love it. They don't even care what kind of pet. It's a bird, it's a bunny, it's a tarantula. They don't care. And of course, stuff about your writing. And that's the biggie. I try to include something about what I'm working on in every email. So a snippet, just a little bit of a scene that I wrote that I think had clever dialogue or was funny. So sneak peeks at work in progress. Cover reveals are always big, of course. Beginning of the year is a great time to say, here's what I'm going to do for the rest of the year. You can expect these books at this time. A year-end roundup is nice. Hey, here's what happened this year. That's also a good chance to sneak in all those links. So if anybody missed a book over the course of the year, they can go pick it up. So yeah, in that order, what are they reading? What are you writing? And then what other things do you have in common, I think, are probably the things to talk about.
No, that's fantastic. Really good list of stuff there. And I do share pictures of where I'm traveling, which is also my book research. So I can say I went here and I'm thinking about a book about this. Always share what I'm reading. This is on my fiction list. And my nonfiction is kind of his useful stuff. So, you know, I send out this a link to this interview in my newsletter to my nonfiction list, which is like, this is useful and this is a useful book and a useful interview. So I think nonfiction, you can just be useful or inspirational, and fiction is kind of entertaining. But I think in general, I love keep coming back to the fun aspect, because what you're talking about is being a bit more lighthearted about your email. Like, don't make it super serious all the time.
No, definitely not. And I think that if you free yourself from the shackles of saying, is this email going to sell me any books? If you stop trying to ROI on every email you send, then I think that you will be in a much better position. That puts you in a place where, like I said, you're talking to people who they like you, one can assume, because they're on your list, and they are like you. They read the sorts of books you write, and probably so do you. And you can just have fun talking to them about stuff. I really think that freeing yourself from that whole sales attitude helps a lot, though, because if you're looking at an email and you're like, okay, how do I slide the sale in? How do I, you know, how do I get the pitch in there? I hope that at least 12 people click through because this took me 30 minutes to write. Like, that's no way to have any fun at all.
That's fantastic. And then another really common question, and we're almost out of time, so this is probably our last one, is how important is list size? Because everyone's like, oh, but I've only got 3 people on my list, and it's okay for you because you've got a big list or whatever. So what are your thoughts on list size? And I guess also cleaning the list, which is kind of heartbreaking.
So it is. It's always hurtful. I keep my list fairly small for reasons I'll talk about in just one second. I keep my list fairly small. So it was only up to, some people are going to be like, that's not small, but it was only up to maybe about 7,000, probably just shy of 7,000 when the GDPR regulations came into effect. And a lot of people did some cleaning. I did some cleaning because back in the early days of building that romance list, I thought the provenance of some of those emails might be a bit sketchy. I ran a couple of promotions that in retrospect, I was like, oh, I'm not so sure. So I made everybody recertify, and I lost literally 3,500 people, just whack. They never opened the emails. They never clicked to stay. And I thought, oh God, but you know, my sales didn't go down. My replies didn't go down. What happened was my open rates went up, because that's math, obviously. Mm-hmm. So ultimately cleaning it out is the best thing you can do for yourself. People, get rid of the dead weight. I do talk about that in Newsletter Ninja only because you want to be careful not to scoop out people who might be opening, but the opens are not registering. So there is a section about that in the book, which I think is really important. But in general, you definitely want to scoop them out. I forgot your initial question. I jumped to the end instead of the beginning.
List size.
Okay. So, how big your list is not the most important metric. I say this, I think, in every podcast interview. Dave Gogren wrote a blog post once, and the title was "The One with the Biggest List Wins." And I was like, delete that, because that's not true. The one with the most engaged list wins. Now, obviously, there's a bottom level. If you've got 10 people on your list, they're not going to help you sell very many books. But those 10 people become 20 people and become 40 people. So what you do is you nurture those 10 people and you keep on list building. What you don't want to have is a list of 20,000 people and only 1,200 of them open. Like, how is that useful to you? How is that helpful? So for me, the metrics I ask people, I never ask people, how many people do you have on your list? I say, what are your open rates? That to me is the most important. Who's looking at those emails? Because if you've got 2,000 people, but you've got an 85% open rate, that's way better than anybody who's got 20,000 people. And I know that only, 800 of them are going to open. So list size matters somewhat in that you have to have some sort of list. But even once you get into just having a few hundred people, you can deploy you can deploy them really well. You can segment the list into three sections and watch your, you know, so that your sales spread over a few days instead of having one of those spikes that Amazon hates. You can get those people to go do other things for you. Come join my Facebook group, go vote in this poll, spread the word to your friends that this contest is going on, something like that. You can really kind of exponentially multiply once you've got a couple hundred people to work with.
Right. So we are out of time, although I could talk to you forever about this. You make email just seem amazing. So I know people are going to find it interesting. So tell us, what else can people find in your book and also in your course?
Okay. So the book and the course have virtually the same material. It was actually super important to me that the book not be a sales card for the course. It was really important to me. So I put everything in there that I could. I get some complaints occasionally because there are no samples. So I'll warn all of you ahead of time. There is nothing that you can cut and paste into your emails. You're going to have to write it all yourself. But other than that, everything I know is in there. This is the book Newsletter Ninja.
It's a fantastic book. Really, seriously, everyone needs this book.
Yay. I'm so happy to hear that. So the book is on all retailers. It's wide, so you can get it at whatever retailer it is that you buy books on. I push people to the book rather than to the course. I only do the course 4 times a year. I'm actually probably going to cut back to 2 times a year by 2020 because I have a new pen name. She needs writing time. So there's that. But so I steer people to the book because a lot of people, they read the book and they can implement that stuff themselves. They don't need the handholding. They really don't need to sit down with me one-on-one. But that's what the course is. Essentially, you get kind of the same material that's in the book. And then every week for 4 weeks, we do a one-on-one video call, me and the students, each of the students. That's why I keep it to 10 because I got stuff to do. But it's awesome. And it really works out well. I do critique their onboardings that they have, help them rewrite if they need to, start from scratch if that's where they're at, which definitely happens. So it's a lot of fun, but start with the book for sure. You can find it at newsletterninja.net. So that's pretty easy. And then if you read through it and you do need help, the course is also there. So you can go and find it there.
Fantastic. And where can people find your main site and all your other books online?
So the only fiction that's published under my own name is a romance that everyone hates. So I love it. Just so you know, I think it's fantastic. The heroine is a little bit unlikable, apparently. You can read the reviews. So that's on my Amazon Author Central page. You can also sign up to the mailing list for that name at tammylebreck.com. But if you want to do the newsletter stuff, if you want to, you know, find out about that, you'll definitely just want to go to newsletterninja.net. And I'm on Facebook under my own name, but mostly I just rant about politics. So, well, I'm also kind of funny, but I do a lot of ranting about politics. So you may or may not want to hit me up
there.
That
is Americans right now. So that's just normal.
Oh, yeah. We're all ranting. No matter what we think, we're all ranting. Right
exactly.
Now.
It doesn't matter what side you're on. But anyway, not a political show. So thank you so much, Tammy. That was really brilliant. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Joanna. It was great to be here.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Tammy today, and I certainly have some to-do items for my list. I'm sure you do too. And her book goes into a lot more detail. So if you're like, oh goodness, I have so many notes, definitely get her book. And it's one of those books you will want on your reference shelf and have it there to remind you that you need to do this stuff. That's what I've done. It's in my do this pile. There you go. So next week, I'm talking to Tara McMullen on how to take your creative business to the next level. And Tara's been on the show before as Tara Gentile, and we do talk about rebranding as well. So we talk about what to do if you feel like you're in a rut and you don't want to blow away everything you've already achieved, dealing with plateaus in your business or a change in direction, why systems matter so much, and how to get away from the launch cycle mentality. So why I love talking to Tara because I learn a lot because of the stage of my business. Obviously I've talked about how many years I've been doing this stuff and how sometimes I feel like just changing direction, but then I feel like I'm continuing to be useful. So I want to keep being useful, but it's good to deal with these plateaus that we sometimes hit and look about how do we take it to another level. It doesn't need to be like the next level in terms of money, but we are creatives. We have minds that like to jump around. So I love talking to Tara, and I know you'll get some good insights next week. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.